guards were inexperienced, he gave no quarter. By the third session, the casualties already included one man permanently deformed, plus four or five suffering from lesser injuries. The wounded were not far off. Their moans could be heard coming from the back of the house. "Next!" shouted Kojiro, brandishing a long sword made of loquat wood. At the beginning, he had told them that a blow struck with a loquat sword will rot your flesh to the bone. "Ready to quit? If you're not, come forward. If you are, I'm going home," he taunted contemptuously. Out of pure chagrin, one man said, "All right, I'll give it a try." He disengaged himself from the group, walked toward Kojiro, then leaned over to pick up a wooden sword. With a sharp crack, Kojiro flattened him. "That," he declared, "is a lesson in why not to leave yourself open. It's the worst thing you can do." With obvious self-satisfaction, he looked around at the faces of the others, 30 to 40 in number, most of them all but visibly trembling. The latest victim was carried to the well, where water was poured over him. He did not come to.
"Poor guy's done for. You mean he's dead? He's not breathing."
Others ran up to stare at their slain comrade. Some were angry, some resigned, but Kojiro didn't give the corpse a second glance.
"If something like this frightens you," he said menacingly, "you'd better forget about the sword. When I think that any one of you would be itching to fight if somebody on the street called you a thug or a braggart..."
He didn't finish the sentence, but as he walked across the field in his leather socks, he continued his lecture.
"Give the matter some thought, my fine hoodlums. You're ready to draw the minute a stranger steps on your toes or brushes against your scabbard, but you're tied up in knots when the time comes for a real bout. You'll throw your lives away cheerfully over a woman or your own petty pride, but you haven't got the guts to sacrifice yourself in a worthy cause. You're emotional, you're moved only by vanity. That's not enough, nowhere near enough."
Throwing his chest out, he concluded,
"The truth is simple. The only real bravery, the only genuine self-confidence, comes from training and self-discipline. I dare any one of you, stand up and fight me like a man."
One student, hoping to make him eat his words, attacked from behind. Kojiro bent double, almost touching the ground, and the assailant flew over his head and landed in front of him. The next instant, there was the loud crack of Kojiro's loquat sword against the man's hip bone.
"That'll be all for today," he said,
tossing the sword aside and going to the well to wash his hands. The corpse was lying in a flaccid heap beside the sink. Kojiro dipped his hands in the water and splashed some on his face without a word of sympathy. Slipping his arm back into his sleeve, he said,
"I hear a lot of people go to this place called Yoshiwara. You men must know the district pretty well. Wouldn't you like to show me around?"
Bluntly announcing that he wanted to have a good time or go drinking was a habit of Kojiro's, but it was a matter of conjecture whether he was being deliberately impudent or disarmingly candid. Yajibe chose the more charitable interpretation.
"Haven't you been to Yoshiwara yet?"
he asked with surprise.
"We'll have to do something about that. I'd go with you myself, but, well, I have to be here this evening for the wake and so on."
He singled out Judo and Koroku and gave them some money. Also a warning.
"Remember, you two, I'm not sending you out to play around. You're only going along to take care of your teacher and see that he has a good time."
Kojiro, a few steps in front of the other two, soon found he had trouble staying on the road, for at night, most of Edo was pitch black, to an extent unimaginable in cities like Kyoto, Nara, and Osaka.
"This road's terrible," he said. "We should have brought a lantern."
"People'd laugh if you went around the license quarter carrying a lantern," said Judo. "Watch out, sir. That pile of dirt you're on came out of the new moat. You'd better come down before you fall in."
Presently, the water in the moat took on a reddish cast, as did the sky beyond the Sumida River. A late spring moon hung like a flat white cake above the roofs of Yoshiwara.
"That's it over there, cross the bridge," said Judo. "Shall I lend you a hand towel?"
"What for?"
"To hide your face a little, like this."
Judo and Koroku both drew red cloths from their obi and tied them kerchief fashion over their heads. Kojiro followed suit, using a piece of russet silk crepe.
"That's the way," said Judo. "Stylish-like."
"Looks very good on you."
Kojiro and his guides fell in with the bandanaed throng sauntering from house to house. Like Yanagimachi in Kyoto, Yoshiwara was brightly lit. The entrances to the houses were gaily decorated with curtains of red or pale yellow. Some had bells at the bottom to let the girls know when customers entered. After they had been in and out of two or three houses, Judo said leeringly to Kojiro,
"There's no use trying to hide it, sir."
"Hide what?"
"You said you'd never been here before, but a girl in the last house recognized you. The minute we went in, she gave a little cry and hid behind a screen. Your secret's out, sir."
"I've never been here before."
"Who are you talking about?
Don't play innocent, sir. Let's go back. I'll show you."
They re-entered the house, whose curtain bore a crest shaped like a bitter buckbean leaf split in three. Sumiya was written in rather small characters to the left. The house's heavy beams and stately corridors were reminiscent of Kyoto temple architecture, but the garish newness nullified the attempt to create an aura of tradition and dignity. Kojiro strongly suspected that swamp plants still thrived beneath the floor. The large parlor they were shown to upstairs had not been straightened up after the last customers. Both table and floor were strewn with bits of food, tissue paper, toothpicks, and whatnot. The maid who came to clean up performed her chore with all the finesse of a day laborer. When Onao arrived to take their orders, she made a point of letting them know how busy she was. She claimed that she hardly had time to sleep, and another 3 years of this hectic pace would put her in her grave. The better houses of Kyoto contrived to maintain the fiction that their raison d'etre was to entertain and please their customers. Here, the aim was obviously to relieve men of their money as quickly as possible.
"So this is Edo's pleasure quarter," sniffed Kojiro, with a critical glance at the knot holes in the ceiling.
"Pretty shoddy, I'd say."
"Oh, this is only temporary," Onao protested. "The building we're putting up now will be finer than anything you'd see in Kyoto or Fushimi."
She stared at Kojiro a moment.
"You know, sir, I've seen you somewhere before." "Ah, yes. It was last year on the Koshu High Road."
Kojiro had forgotten the chance meeting, but reminded of it, he said with a spark of interest,
"Why, yes. I guess our fates must be entwined."
"I should say they are," Judo said, laughing, "if there's a girl here who remembers you."
While teasing Kojiro about his past, he described the girl's face and clothing and asked Onao to go find her.
"I know the one you mean," said Onao, and went to fetch her.
When some time had passed and she still hadn't come back, Judo and Koroku went out in the hall and clapped their hands to summon her. They had to clap several more times before she finally reappeared.
"She's not here, the one you asked for," said Onao.
"She was here only a few minutes ago."
"It's strange. Just as I was saying to the master, we were at Kobotoke Pass, and that samurai you're with came walking along the road, and she went off by herself that time, too."
Behind the sumiya stood the frame of the new building, roof partly finished, no walls.
"Hanagiri! Hanagiri!"
This was the name they had given Akemi, who was hiding between a stack of lumber and a small mountain of shavings. Several times, the searchers had passed so close she had had to hold her breath.
"How disgusting," she thought.
For the first few minutes, her wrath had been directed at Kojiro alone. By now, it had expanded to embrace every member of the masculine sex. Hojiro, Seijuro, the samurai at Hachioji, the customers who manhandled her nightly at the Sumiya. All men were her enemies, all abominable. Except one. The right one. The one who would be like Musashi. The one she had sought incessantly. Having given up on the real Musashi, she had now persuaded herself that it would be comforting to pretend to be in love with someone similar to him. Much to her chagrin, she found no one remotely like him.
Hanagiri!
It was Shoji Jinnai himself, first shouting from the back of the house, now drawing closer to her hiding place. He was accompanied by Kojiro and the other two men. They had complained at tiresome length, making Jinnai repeat his apologies over and over, but finally they went off toward the street. Akemi, seeing them go, breathed a sigh of relief and waited until Jinnai went back inside, then ran straight to the kitchen door.
"Why, Hanagiri, were you out there all the time?"
the kitchen maid asked hysterically.
"Shh, be quiet and give me some sake."
"Sake? Now?"
"Yes, sake!"
Since coming to Edo, the times when Akemi had sought solace in sake had become more and more frequent. The frightened maid poured her a large cupful. Shutting her eyes, Akemi drained the vessel dry, her powdered face tilted back until it was almost parallel with the white bottom of the cup. As she turned away from the door, the maid cried in alarm,
"Where are you off to now?"
"Shut up. I'll just wash my feet, then go back inside." Taking her at her word, the maid shut the door and returned to her work. Akemi slipped her feet into the first pair of zori she saw and walked somewhat unsteadily to the street.
"How good to be out in the open,"
was her first reaction, but this was followed very closely by revulsion. She spat in the general direction of the pleasure-seekers strolling along the brightly lit road and took to her heels. Coming to a place where stars were reflected in a moat, she stopped to look. She heard running feet behind her.
"Uh-oh! Lanterns this time! And they're from the Sumiya! Animals! Can't they even let a girl have a few minutes' peace? No! Find her! Put her back to making money! Turning flesh and blood into a little lumber for their new house. That's the only thing that'll satisfy them. Well, they won't get me back."
The curled wood shavings hanging loosely in her hair bobbed up and down as she ran as fast as her legs would carry her into the darkness. She had no idea where she was going and couldn't have cared less, so long as it was away, far away. The Owl. When they finally forsook the tea house, Kojiro was barely able to stand.
"Shoulder! Shoulder!"
he gurgled, grabbing onto both Judo and Koroku for support. The three lumbered uncertainly down the dark, deserted street. Judo said,
"Sir, I told you we should spend the night." "In that dive? Not on your life! I'd rather go back to the Sumiya." "I wouldn't, sir." "Why not?" "That girl, she ran away from you. If they find her, she could be forced to go to bed with you. But for what? You wouldn't enjoy it then."
Maybe you're right."
"Do you want her?"
"Nah."
"But you can't quite get her out of your mind, can you?" "I've never fallen in love in my life. I'm not the type. I've got more important things to do." "What, sir?" "Obvious, my boy. I'm going to be the best, most famous swordsman ever, and the quickest way to do that is to be the shogun's teacher." "But he already has the House of Yagyu to teach him, and I hear he recently hired Ono Jiroemon." "Ono Jiroemon? Who gives a fart about him? The Yagyus don't impress me much either. You watch me. One of these days."
They had reached the stretch of road along which the new moat was being dug, and soft dirt was piled halfway up the willow trees.
"Watch out, sir! It's very slippery,"
said Judo, as he and Koroku tried to help their teacher down from the pile of dirt.
"Hold it!"
Kojiro shouted, abruptly shoving the two men away. He slid rapidly down the dirt pile.
"Who's there?"
The man who had just lunged at Kojiro's back lost his balance and tumbled headfirst into the moat.
"Have you forgotten, Sasaki?
You killed four of our comrades!"
Kojiro jumped to the top of the dirt pile, from where he could see that there were at least 10 men among the trees, partly hidden by rushes. Swords pointed at him, they slowly began closing in.
"So you're from the Obata school, are you?"
he said in a contemptuous tone. The sudden action had sobered him completely.
"Last time you lost 4 men out of 5. How many of you came tonight? How many want to die? Just give me the number, and I'll oblige. Cowards, attack if you dare!"
His hand went deftly over his shoulder to the hilt of the drying pole. Obata Nichijō, before taking the tonsure, had been one of the most celebrated warriors in Kai, a province famous for its heroic samurai. After the defeat of the House of Takeda by Tokugawa Ieyasu, the Obata family had lived in obscurity until Kagenori distinguished himself at the Battle of Sekigahara. He had subsequently been summoned into service by Ieyasu himself and had gained fame as a teacher of military science. He had, however, refused the shogunate's offer of a choice plot of land in central Edo with the plea that a country warrior like himself would feel out of place there. He preferred a wooded lot adjoining Hirakawa Tenjin Shrine, where he had established his school in an ancient thatched farmhouse to which had been added a new lecture hall and a rather imposing entrance. Now advanced in years and suffering from a neural disorder, Kagenori had been confined to his sick room in recent months, appearing only rarely in the lecture hall. The woods were full of owls, and he had taken to signing his name as Old Man Owl. Sometimes he'd smile weakly and say, "I'm an owl like the others." Not infrequently, the pain from the waist up was agonizing. Tonight had been one of those times.
"Feel a little better? Would you like some water?"
The speaker was Hōjō Shinzō, son of Hōjō Ujikatsu, the celebrated military strategist.
"I'm much more comfortable now," said Kagenori. "Why don't you go to bed? It'll soon be light."
The invalid's hair was white. His frame was skinny and angular as an aged plum tree.
"Don't worry about me. I get plenty of sleep during the day."
"You can't have much time left for sleeping when you spend your days taking over my lectures. You're the only one who can do that."
"Sleeping too much isn't good discipline."
Noticing that the lamp was about to go out, Shinzō stopped rubbing the old man's back and went to fetch some oil. When he returned, Kagenori, still lying on his stomach, had raised his bony face from the pillow. The light was reflected eerily in his eyes.
"What is it, sir?"
"Don't you hear it? It sounds like splashing water."
"It seems to be coming from the well."
"Who would it be at this hour? Do you suppose some of the men have been out drinking again?"
"That's probably it, but I'll take a look anyhow."
"Give them a good scolding while you're at it."
"Yes, sir. You'd better go to sleep. You must be tired."
When Kagenori's pain had subsided and he had dropped off to sleep, Shinzō carefully tucked the covers up around his shoulders and went to the back door. Two students were leaning over the well bucket, washing blood off their faces and hands. He ran toward them with a scowl on his face.
"You went, didn't you?" he said curtly. "After I pleaded with you not to?"
The exasperation in his voice faded when he saw a third man lying in the shadow of the well. From the way he was groaning, it sounded as if he might die from his wounds at any moment. Like little boys begging for help from an older brother, both men, their faces oddly twisted, sobbed uncontrollably.
Fools!
Shinzo had to restrain himself from giving them a thrashing.
How many times did I warn you? You were no match for him. Why didn't you listen?
After he dragged our master's name through the mud? After he killed four of our men?
You keep saying we're not being reasonable. Aren't you the one who's lost his reason? Controlling your temper, holding yourself back, bearing insults in silence. Is that what you call reasonable? That's not the way of the samurai. Isn't it? If confronting Sasaki Kojiro was the thing to do, I'd have challenged him myself. He went out of his way to insult our teacher and commit other outrages against us. But that's no excuse for losing our sense of proportion. I'm not afraid to die, but Kojiro is not worth risking my life or anybody else's over. That's not the way most people see it. They think we're afraid of him, afraid to stand up for our honor. Kojiro's been maligning Kagenori all over Edo. If he wants to run off at the mouth, let him. Do you think anybody who knows Kagenori is going to believe he lost an argument to that conceited novice?
Do as you please, Shinzo. The rest of us are not going to sit by and do nothing.
Just exactly what do you have in mind?
Only one thing. Kill him.
You think you can? I told you not to go to the Sensoji. You wouldn't listen. Four men died. You've just returned after being defeated by him again. Isn't that piling shame on dishonor? It's not Kojiro who's destroying Kagenori's reputation. It's you. I have one question. Did you kill him?
There was no answer.
Of course not. I'll bet anything he doesn't have a scratch on him. The trouble with you is you don't have enough sense to avoid meeting him on his own terms. You don't understand his strength. True, he's young. He's of low character. He's coarse. He's arrogant. But he's an outstanding swordsman. How he learned his skill, I don't know. But there's no denying he has it. You underestimate him. That's your first mistake.
One man pressed in on Shinzo as though ready to attack him physically.
You're saying that whatever the bastard does, there's nothing we can do about it.
Shinzo nodded defiantly.
Exactly. There's nothing we can do. We're not swordsmen. We're students of military science. If you think my attitude is cowardly, then I'll just have to put up with being called a coward.
The wounded man at their feet moaned,
Water! Water! Please!
His two comrades knelt and propped him into a sitting position. Seeing they were about to give him some water, Shinzo cried in alarm,
Stop! If he drinks water, it'll kill him!
As they hesitated, the man put his mouth to the bucket. One swallow, and his head collapsed into it, bringing the night's death toll to 5. While the owls hooted at the morning moon, Shinzo silently returned to the sick room. Kagenori was still asleep, breathing deeply. Reassured, Shinzo went to his own cubicle. Works on military science lay open on his desk, books he had begun reading but had had no time to finish. Though well-born, as a child he had done his share of splitting firewood, carrying water and studying long hours by candlelight. His father, a great samurai, did not believe that young men of his class should be pampered. Shinzo had entered the Obata school with the ultimate aim of strengthening military skills in his family's fief, and though one of the younger students, he ranked highest in his teacher's estimation. These days, caring for his ailing master kept him awake most of the night. He sat now with his arms folded and heaved a deep sigh. Who would look after Kagenori if he were not there? All the other students living at the school were of an uncouth type, typically attracted to military matters. The men who came to the school only for classes were even worse. They blustered about, voicing opinions on the masculine subjects that samurai habitually discussed. None of them really understood the spirit of the lonely man of reason who was their teacher. The finer points of military science went over their heads. Far more comprehensible was any kind of slur, either real or fancied, against their pride or their ability as samurai. Insulted, they became mindless instruments of vengeance. Shinzo had been away on a trip when Kojiro arrived at the school. Since Kojiro had claimed that he wanted to ask some questions about military textbooks, his interest seemed genuine, and he had been introduced to the master. But then, without asking a single question, he began arguing with Kagenori presumptuously and arrogantly, which suggested that his real purpose was to humiliate the old man. When some students finally got him into another room and demanded an explanation, he reacted with a flood of invective and an offer to fight any one of them at any time. Kojiro had then spread allegations that Obata's military studies were superficial, that they were no more than a rehash of the Kusunoki style or the ancient Chinese military text known as the Six Secrets, and that they were spurious and unreliable. When his malicious pronouncements got back to the ears of the students, they vowed to make him pay with his life. Shinzo's opposition, the problem, was trivial. Their master ought not to be disturbed by matters of this sort. Kojiro was not a serious student of military science, had proved futile, though he had also pointed out that before any decisive step was taken, Kagenori's son, Yogoro, who was away on a long journey, should be consulted.
"Can't they see how much useless trouble they're causing?" lamented Shinzo.
The fading light of the lamp dimly illuminated his troubled face. Still racking his brain for a solution, he laid his arms across the open books and dozed off. He awoke to the murmur of indistinct voices. Going first to the lecture hall and finding it empty, he slipped on a pair of zori and went outside. In a bamboo grove that was part of the sacred compound of the Hirakawa Tenjin Shrine, he saw what he had expected, a large group of students holding an emotion-charged council of war. The two wounded men, their faces ashen, their arms suspended in white slings, stood side by side, describing the night's disaster. One man asked indignantly,
"Are you saying 10 of you went and half were killed by this one man?"
"I'm afraid so. We couldn't even get close to him. Murata and Ayabe were supposed to be our best swordsmen. They were the first to go. Yosobe managed by sheer guts to get back here, but he made the mistake of drinking some water before we could stop him."
A grim silence descended over the group. As students of military science, they were concerned with problems of logistics, strategy, communications, intelligence, and so on, not with the techniques of hand-to-hand combat. Most of them believed, as they had been taught, that swordsmanship was a matter for ordinary soldiers, not generals. Yet their samurai pride stood in the way of their accepting the logical corollary, which was that they were helpless against an expert swordsman like Sasaki Kojiro.
"What can we do?" asked a mournful voice.
For a time, the only answer was the hooting of the owls. Then one student said brightly,
"I have a cousin in the house of Yagyu. Maybe through him we could get them to help us."
"Don't be stupid," shouted several others. "We can't ask for outside help. It'll only bring more shame on our teacher. It'll be an admission of weakness."
"Well, what can we do?"
"The only way is to confront Kojiro again, but if we do it on a dark road again, it'll only do more damage to the school's reputation. If we die in open battle, we die. At least we won't be thought of as cowards."
"Should we send him a formal challenge?"
"Yes, and we have to keep at it, no matter how many times we lose."
"I think you're right, but Shinzo isn't going to like this."
"He doesn't have to know about it, nor does our master. Remember that, all of you. We can borrow brush and ink from the priest."
They started quietly for the priest's house. Before they had gone 10 paces, the man in the lead gasped and stepped back. The others instantly came to a dead halt, their eyes riveted on the back veranda of the time-worn shrine building. There, against a backdrop formed by the shadow of a plum tree laden with green fruit, stood Kojiro, one foot propped on the railing and a malevolent grin on his face. To a man, the students turned pale. Some had trouble breathing. Kojiro's voice was venomous.
I gather from your discussion that you still haven't learned, that you've decided to write a letter of challenge and have it delivered to me. Well, I've saved you the trouble. I'm here, ready to fight. Last night, before I'd even washed the blood off my hands, I came to the conclusion there'd be a sequel, so I followed you sniveling cowards home.
He paused to let this sink in, then continued in an ironic tone.
I was wondering how you'd decide on the time and place to challenge an enemy. Do you consult a horoscope to pick the most propitious day? Or do you consider it wiser not to draw your swords until there comes a dark night when your opponent is drunk and on his way home from the licensed quarter?
He paused again, as though waiting for an answer.
Have you nothing to say? Isn't there a single red-blooded man among you? If you're so eager to fight me, come on! One at a time, or all at once! It's all the same to me! I wouldn't run from the likes of you if you were in full armor and marching to the beat of drums!
No sound came from the cowed men.
What's the matter with you?
The pauses grew longer.
Have you decided not to challenge me? Isn't there even one among you with some backbone? All right, it's time now to open your stupid ears and listen. I am Sasaki Kojiro. I learned the art of the sword indirectly from the great Toda Seigen after his death. I know the secrets of unsheathing invented by Katayama Hisayasu, and I have myself created the Gandyu style. I'm not like those who deal in theory, who read books and listen to lectures on Sun Tzu or the Six Secrets. In spirit, in will, you and I have nothing in common. I don't know the details of your daily study, but I'm showing you now what the science of fighting is all about in real life. I'm not bragging. Think. When a man is set upon in the dark, as I was last night, if he has the good fortune to win, what does he do? If he's an ordinary man, he goes as quickly as he can to a safe place. Once there, he thinks back over the incident and congratulates himself on having survived. Isn't that right? Isn't that what you would do? But did I do that? No! Not only did I cut down half of your men, I followed the stragglers home and waited here, right under your noses. I listened while you tried to make up your weak minds, and I took you completely by surprise. If I wanted to, I could attack now and smash you to bits. That's what it means to be a military man. That's the secret of military science. Some of you have said Sasaki Kojiro is just a swordsman, that he had no business coming to a military school and shooting off his mouth. How far do I have to go to convince you how wrong you are? Perhaps today I'll also prove to you that I'm not only the greatest swordsman in the country, but also a master of tactics. Aha! This is turning into quite a little lecture, isn't it? I'm afraid if I continue to pour out my fund of knowledge, poor Obata Kagenori may find himself out of a stipend. That wouldn't do, would it? Oh, I'm thirsty. Koroku, Judo, get me some water.
Right away, sir,
they replied in unison from beside the shrine, where they had been watching in rapt admiration. Having brought him a large earthen cup of water, Judo asked eagerly,
What are you going to do, sir?
Ask them,
Kojiro sneered.
Your answer's in those weaselly empty faces.
Did you ever see men look so stupid?
Kodoku laughed.
What a gutless bunch, said Judo. Come on, sir, let's go. They're not going to stand up to you.
While the three of them swaggered through the shrine gate, Shinzo, concealed among the trees, muttered through clenched teeth,
I'll get you for this.
The students were despondent. Kojiro had outwitted and defeated them. Then he'd gloated, leaving them frightened and humiliated. The silence was broken by a student running up and asking in a bewildered tone, "Did we order coffins?" When no one replied, he said, "The coffin maker's just arrived with 5 coffins. He's waiting." Finally, one of the group answered dispiritedly, "The bodies have been sent for. They haven't arrived yet." "I'm not sure, but I think we'll need one more coffin. Ask him to make it and put the ones he brought in the storehouse." That night, a wake was held in the lecture hall. Though everything was done quietly, in the hope that Kagenori would not hear, he was able to guess more or less what had occurred. He refrained from asking questions, nor did Shinzo make any comment. From that day, the stigma of defeat hung over the school. Only Shinzo, who had urged restraint and been accused of cowardice, kept alive the desire for revenge. His eyes harbored a glint that none of the others could fathom. In early fall, Kagenori's illness worsened. Visible from his bedside was an owl perched on a limb of a large zelkova tree, staring, never moving, hooting at the moon in the daytime. Shinzo now heard in the owl's hoot the message that his master's end was near. Then a letter arrived from Yogoro saying he had heard about Kojiro and was on his way home. For the next few days, Shinzo wondered which would come first, the arrival of the son or the death of the father. In either case, the day for which he was waiting, the day of his release from his obligations, was at hand. On the evening before Yogoro was expected, Shinzo left a farewell letter on his desk and took his leave of the Obata school. From the woods near the shrine, he faced Kagenori's sick room and said softly,
"Forgive me for leaving without your permission. Rest at ease, good master. Yogoro will be home tomorrow. I don't know if I can present Kojiro's head to you before you die, but I must try. If I should die trying, I shall await you in the land of the dead."
A Plate of Loaches. Musashi had been roaming the countryside, devoting himself to ascetic practices, punishing his body to perfect his soul. He was more resolved than ever to go it alone, if that meant being hungry, sleeping out in the open in cold and rain, and walking about in filthy rags, then so be it. In his heart was a dream that would never be satisfied by taking a position in Lord Date's employ, even if his lordship were to offer him his entire 3 million bushel fief. After the long trip up the Nakasendo, he had spent only a few nights in Edo before taking to the road again, this time north to Sendai. The money given him by Ishimoda Geki had been a burden on his conscience. From the moment he'd discovered it, he'd known he'd find no peace until it was returned. Now, a year and a half later, he found himself on Hotengahara, a plain in Shimosa province, east of Edo, little changed since the rebellious Tairano Masakado and his troops had rampaged through the area in the 10th century. The plain was a dismal place still, sparsely settled and growing nothing of value, only weeds, a few trees, and some scrubby bamboo and rushes. The sun, low on the horizon, reddened the pools of stagnant water, but left the grass and brush colorless and indistinct. "What now?" Musashi mumbled, resting his weary legs at a crossroads. His body felt listless and still waterlogged from the cloudburst he'd been caught in a few days earlier at Tochigi Pass. The raw evening damp made him eager to find human habitation. For the past 2 nights he'd slept under the stars, but now he longed for the warmth of a hearth and some real food, even simple peasant fare such as millet boiled with rice. A touch of saltiness in the breeze suggested that the sea was near. If he headed toward it, he reasoned, he just might find a house, perhaps even a fishing village or small port. If not, then he'd have to resign himself to yet another night in the autumn grasses, under the great autumn moon. He realized with no small hint of irony that, were he a more poetic type, he might savor these moments in a poignantly lonely landscape. As it was, he wanted only to escape it, to be with people, to have some decent food and get some rest. Yet the incessant buzzing of the insects seemed to be reciting a litany to his solitary wandering. Musashi stopped on a dirt-covered bridge. A definite splashing noise seemed to rise above the peaceful rippling of the narrow river. An otter? In the fading daylight, he strained his eyes until he could just make out a figure kneeling in the hollow by the water's edge. He chuckled to note that the face of the young boy peering up at him was distinctly otter-like. "What are you up to down there?" Musashi called in a friendly voice.
"Loaches,"
was the laconic reply. The boy was shaking a wicker basket in the water to clean the mud and sand off his wriggling catch. "Catch many?" Musashi inquired, loath to sever this newly found bond with another human.
"Aren't many around. It's already fall."
"How about letting me have some?"
"My loaches?"
"Yes, just a handful. I'll pay you for them."
"Sorry. These are for my father."
Hugging the basket, he leapt nimbly up the bank and was off like a shot into the darkness. "Speedy little devil, I must say." Musashi, alone once again, laughed. He was reminded of his own childhood and of Jotaro. "I wonder what's become of him," he mused. Jotaro had been 14 when Musashi had last seen him. Soon he would be 16. Poor boy. He accepted me as his teacher, loved me as his teacher, served me as his teacher, and what did I do for him? Nothing. Absorbed in his memories, he forgot his fatigue. He stopped and stood still. The moon had risen, bright and full. It was on nights like this that Otsu liked to play the flute. In the insects' voices, he heard the sound of laughter, Otsu's and Jotaro's together. Turning his head to one side, he spotted a light. He turned the rest of his body in the same direction and made straight for it. Lespediza grew all around the isolated shack, almost as high as the lopsided roof. The walls were covered with calabash vines, the blossoms looking from a distance like enormous dewdrops. As he drew near, he was startled by the great angry snort of an unsaddled horse tied up beside the hovel. "Who's there?" Musashi recognized the voice coming from the shacks as that of the boy with the loaches. Smiling, he called, "How about putting me up for the night? I'll leave first thing in the morning." The boy came to the door and looked Musashi over carefully. After a moment, he said, "All right, come in." The house was as rickety as any Musashi had ever seen. Moonlight poured through cracks in the walls and roof. After removing his cloak, he couldn't find even a peg to hang it on. Wind from below made the floor drafty, despite the reed mat covering it. The boy knelt before his guest in formal fashion and said, "Back there at the river, you said you wanted some loaches, didn't you? Do you like loaches?" In these surroundings, the boy's formality so surprised Musashi that he merely stared.
"What are you looking at?"
"How old are you?"
12.
Musashi was impressed by his face. It was as dirty as a lotus root just pulled out of the ground, and his hair looked and smelled like a bird's nest. Yet there was character in his expression. His cheeks were chubby, and his eyes, shining like beads through the encircling grime, were magnificent.
"I have a little millet and rice," said the boy hospitably, "and now that I've given some to my father, you can have the rest of the loaches if you want them."
"Thanks.
I suppose you'd like some tea, too."
"Yes, if it's not too much trouble."
"Wait here."
He pushed open a screechy door and went into the next room. Musashi heard him breaking firewood, then fanning the flame in an earthen hibachi. Before long, the smoke filling the shack drove a host of insects outdoors. The boy came back with a tray, which he placed on the floor in front of Musashi. Falling to immediately, Musashi devoured the salty broiled loaches, the millet and rice, and the Swedish black bean paste in record time.
"That was good," he said gratefully.
"Was it really?" The boy seemed to take pleasure in another person's happiness. "A well-behaved lad," thought Musashi. "I'd like to express my thanks to the head of the house. Has he gone to bed?" "No, he's right in front of you." The boy pointed at his own nose.
"Are you here all alone?"
"Yes."
"Oh, I see."
There was an awkward pause.
"And what do you do for a living?" Musashi asked.
"I rent out the horse and go along as a groom. We used to farm a little, too." "Oh, we've run out of lamp oil. You must be ready for bed anyway, aren't you?"
Musashi agreed that he was, and lay down on a worn straw pallet spread next to the wall.
The hum of the insects was soothing. He fell asleep, but perhaps because of his physical exhaustion, he broke into a sweat. Then he dreamed he heard rain falling. The sound in his dream made him sit up with a start. No mistake about it. What he heard now was a knife or sword being honed. As he reached reflexively for his sword, the boy called in to him, "Can't you sleep?"
How had he known that?
Amazed, Musashi said, "What are you doing sharpening a blade at this hour?" The question was uttered so tensely that it sounded more like the counterblow of a sword than an inquiry. The boy broke into laughter. "Did I scare you? You look too strong and brave to be frightened so easily."
Musashi was silent.
He wondered if he had come upon an all-seeing demon in the guise of a peasant boy. When the scraping of the blade on the whetstone began again, Musashi went to the door. Through a crack, he could see that the other room was a kitchen with a small sleeping space at one end. The boy was kneeling in the moonlight next to the window with a large jug of water at his side. The sword he was sharpening was of a type farmers used.
"What do you intend to do with that?" asked Musashi.
The boy glanced toward the door but continued with his work. After a few more minutes, he wiped the blade, which was about a foot and a half long, and held it up to inspect it. It glistened brightly in the moonlight. "Look," he said, "do you think I can cut a man in half with this?"
"Depends on whether you know how."
"Oh, I'm sure I do."
"Do you have someone particular in mind?"
"My father."
"Your father?" Musashi pushed open the door. "I hope that's not your idea of a joke."
"I'm not joking."
"You can't mean you intend to kill your father. Even the rats and wasps in this forsaken wilderness have better sense than to kill their parents."
"But if I don't cut him in two, I can't carry him."
"Carry him where?"
"I have to take him to the burial ground."
"You mean he's dead?"
"Yes." Musashi looked again at the far wall. It had not occurred to him that the bulky shape he had seen there might be a body. Now he saw that it was indeed the corpse of an old man, laid out straight with a pillow under its head and a kimono draped over it. By its side was a bowl of rice, a cup of water, and a helping of broiled loaches on a wooden plate. Recalling how he had unwittingly asked the boy to share the loaches intended as an offering to the dead man's spirit, Musashi felt a twinge of embarrassment. At the same time, he admired the boy for having the coolness to conceive of cutting the body into pieces so as to be able to carry it. His eyes riveted on the boy's face. For a few moments, he said nothing.
"When did he die?"
"This morning."
"How far away is the graveyard?"
"It's up in the hills."
"Couldn't you have got somebody to take him there for you?"
"I don't have any money."
"Let me give you some." The boy shook his head.
"No. My father didn't like to accept gifts. He didn't like to go to the temple either. I can manage, thank you." From the boy's spirit and courage, his stoic yet practical manner, Musashi suspected that his father had not been born an ordinary peasant. There had to be something to explain the son's remarkable self-sufficiency. In deference to the dead man's wishes, Musashi kept his money and instead offered to contribute the strength needed to transport the body in one piece. The boy agreed, and together they loaded the corpse on the horse. When the road got steep, they took it off the horse, and Musashi carried it on his back. The graveyard turned out to be a small clearing under a chestnut tree, where a solitary round stone served as a marker. After the burial, the boy placed some flowers on the grave and said, "My grandfather, grandmother, and mother are buried here too." He folded his hands in prayer. Musashi joined him in silent supplication for the family's repose. "The gravestone doesn't seem to be very old," he remarked. "When did your family settle here?"
"During my grandfather's time."
"Where were they before that?"
"My grandfather was a samurai in the Mogami clan, but after his lord's defeat, he burned our genealogy and everything else. There was nothing left."
"I don't see his name carved on the stone. There's not even a family crest or a date."
"When he died, he ordered that nothing appear on the stone. He was very strict. One time some men came from the Gamo fief, another time from the Date fief, and offered him a position, but he refused. He said a samurai shouldn't serve more than one master. That was the way he was about the stone, too. Since he'd become a farmer, he said putting his name on it would reflect shame on his dead lord."
"Do you know your grandfather's name?"
"Yes. It was Misawa Iori. My father, since he was only a farmer, dropped the surname and just called himself Sanemon."
"And your name?"
"Sannosuke."
"Do you have any relatives?"
"An older sister, but she went away a long time ago. I don't know where she is."
"No one else?"
"No."
"How do you plan to make your living now?"
"Same as before, I guess."
But then he added hurriedly, "Look, you're a shugyosha, aren't you? You must travel around just about everywhere.
Take me with you.
You can ride my horse and I'll be your groom."
As Musashi turned the boy's request over in his mind, he gazed out upon the land below them. Since it was fertile enough to support a plethora of weeds, he could not understand why it was not cultivated.
It was certainly not because the people hereabouts were well off. He had seen evidence of poverty everywhere.
"Civilization," Musashi was thinking, "does not flourish until men have learned to exercise control over the forces of nature." He wondered why the people here in the center of the Kanto Plain were so powerless, why they allowed themselves to be oppressed by nature. As the sun rose, Musashi caught glimpse of small animals and birds reveling in the riches that man had not yet learned to harvest. Or so it seemed. He was soon reminded that Sannosuke, despite his courage and independence, was still a child. By the time the sunlight made the dewy foliage glisten and they were ready to start back, the boy was no longer sad, seemed, in fact, to have put all thoughts of his father completely out of mind. Halfway down the hill, he began badgering Musashi for an answer to his proposal. "I'm ready to start today," he declared. "Just think, anywhere you go, you'll be able to ride the horse, and I'll be there to wait on you." This elicited a non-committal grunt. While Sannosuke had much to recommend him, Musashi questioned whether he should again put himself in the position of being responsible for a boy's future. Jotaro, he had natural ability, but how had he benefited by attaching himself to Musashi? And now that he had disappeared to heaven knew where, Musashi felt his responsibility even more keenly. Still, Musashi thought, if a man dwells only on the dangers ahead, he cannot advance a single step, let alone make his way through life successfully. Furthermore, in the case of a child, no one, not even his parents, can actually guarantee his future.
Is it really possible to decide objectively what's good for a child and what's not?
he asked himself. If it's a matter of developing Sanosuke's talents and guiding him in the right direction, I can do that. I guess that's about as much as anyone can do.
Promise, won't you? Please? The boy insisted.
Sanosuke, do you want to be a groom all your life?
Of course not. I want to be a samurai.
That's what I thought. But if you come with me and become my pupil, you'll be in for a lot of rough times, you know.
The boy threw down the rope, and before Musashi knew what he was up to, knelt on the ground below the horse's head. Bowing deeply, he said,
I beg you, sir, make a samurai of me. That's what my father wanted, but there was no one we could ask for help.
Musashi dismounted, looked around for a moment, then picked up a stick and handed it to Sanosuke. He found another one for himself and said,
I want you to strike me with that stick. After I've seen how you handle it, I can decide whether you have the talent to be a samurai.
If I hit you, will you say yes?
Try it and see, Musashi laughed.
Sanosuke took a firm grip on his weapon and rushed forward as if possessed. Musashi showed no mercy. Time and again, the boy was struck on the shoulders, in the face, on the arms. After each setback, he staggered away but always came back to the attack.
Pretty soon he'll be in tears, thought Musashi.
But Sanosuke would not give up. When his stick broke in two, he charged empty-handed.
What do you think you're doing, you runt?
Musashi snapped with deliberate meanness. He seized the boy by his obi and threw him flat on the ground.
You big bastard!
Shouted Sanosuke, already on his feet and attacking again. Musashi caught him by the waist and held him up in the air.
Had enough?
No!
He shouted defiantly, though the sun was in his eyes and he was reduced to uselessly waving his arms and legs.
I'm going to throw you against that rock over there. It'll kill you. Ready to give up?
No!
Stubborn, aren't you? Can't you see you're beaten?
Not as long as I'm alive, I'm not. You'll see, I'll win in the end.
How do you expect to do that?
I'll practice. I'll discipline myself.
But while you're practicing for 10 years, I'll be doing the same thing.
Yes, but you're a lot older than I am. You'll die first. And when they put you in a coffin, I'll strike the final blow and win.
Fool!
Shouted Musashi, tossing the boy to the ground. When Sanosuke stood up, Musashi looked at his face for a moment, laughed, and clapped his hands together once.
Good! You can be my pupil.
Like teacher, like pupil. On the short journey back to the shack, Sanosuke rattled on and on about his dreams for the future. But that night, when Musashi told him he should be ready to bid farewell to the only home he had ever known, he became wistful. They sat up late, and Sanosuke, misty-eyed and speaking in a soft voice, shared his memories of parents and grandparents. In the morning, while they were preparing to move out, Musashi announced that henceforth he would call Sanosuke Yori.
If you're going to become a samurai, he explained, it's only proper that you take your grandfather's name.
The boy was not yet old enough for his coming-of-age ceremony, when he would normally have been given his adult name. Musashi thought taking his grandfather's name would give him something to live up to. Later, when the boy seemed to be lingering inside the house, Musashi said quietly but firmly,
Yori, hurry up. There's nothing in there you need. You don't want reminders of the past.
Iori came flying out in a kimono barely covering his thighs, a groom's straw sandals on his feet, and a cloth wrapper containing a boxed lunch of millet and rice in his hand. He looked like a little frog, but he was ready and eager for a new life.
Pick a tree away from the house and tie the horse up, Musashi commanded.
You may as well mount it now.
Do as I say.
Yes, sir.
Musashi noted the politeness. It was a small but encouraging sign of the boy's readiness to adopt the ways of the samurai in place of the slovenly speech of peasants. Iori tied up the horse and came back to where Musashi was standing under the eaves of the old shack, gazing at the surrounding plain.
What's he waiting for? Wondered the boy.
Putting his hand on Iori's head, Musashi said, "This is where you were born and where you acquired your determination to win." Iori nodded. "Rather than serve a second lord, your grandfather withdrew from the warrior class. Your father, true to your grandfather,